Welcome to Paul or Nothing, the place to get all of your Paul all of the time. Join me, your host Sam Wiles, as we discover the history, the music, and the man behind it all, Paul McCartney. To get in contact with the show, email us at paulmccartneypod@gmail.com. Greetings, hello, and welcome all to another episode of Paul or Nothing, where we leave no stone unturned when it comes to discussing all things concerning the Big Mac himself, Paul McCartney. Essentially, folks, this is a quick episode I wanted to get out there for you. I've found myself with a lot more free time, shall we say, so I wanted to make something a little bit extra for you. Essentially, I just wanted to kind of experiment with some kind of new, expansive content for the show. Like I say, I'm always trying to find new avenues and new ways to get Paul-related stuff out there for you and to make it as interesting as possible. And to keep it interesting, we're going to try and change it up. Today, instead of doing an album review where we kind of go song by song through an album and we discuss its history and its backstory, instead we're going to be reviewing one specific live performance from Paul. Today it will be Wings, but obviously in the future that will leave a lot more room to do other solo work from Paul. We're not necessarily reviewing a live album, as it were. We're actually be reviewing the gigs themselves. I've seen a lot of other podcasts and YouTube channels do similar things to this, so, you know, who am I to argue with what works? And, you know, just any excuse to spend long, hot summer afternoons listening to Wings bootlegs is always just far too irresistible to pass up anyway. Now, is it fair that I'm going to be reviewing single gigs on their own? As we know, you know, Wings is a band that's had many ups and downs over the years, so is it fair of me to pick on one particular moment in their history and kind of judge them, you know, base my opinion on them based on that one pocket in time? It's not particularly fair, but it's also interesting to see how Paul and, to some extent, Wings changed and perfected their live stage craft over the years. And rather than doing that in chronological order like we've been doing with the rest of the show, I thought it would be fun just to pick random performances here and there so we can just get a more broad understanding of Paul. And in that sense, I'll be able to jump ahead of where we are in the podcast. I'll be discussing Back to the Egg on this episode, which is an album we haven't covered yet. To some extent, I'll be discussing McCartney 2. That's another episode we're yet to come to. But obviously, in the future, I could be talking about a live performance of Paul from 2002, and we're not even out of Wings yet, so same as usual, though, despite the fact this is going to be a short episode, we've still got a little bit of housekeeping to attend to before we start. Obviously, contact me on the email, contact us on the email. I'd love to hear you guys, your thoughts on the show. Any stories you have about Paul personally. Maybe you've met him, maybe you play his music. Maybe there's an album you want to talk about that we haven't covered yet. Maybe you want to argue about something that I've talked about before. Obviously, this is a wonderful community of you guys out there, and I love hearing from you. I want to make this more of a community show. So write in and I'll read out all of your emails on the show. Be glad to do it. I've had some wonderful correspondence already and I'd just like to keep it up. And that email is paulmccartneypod@gmail.com. That's paulmccartneypod@gmail.com. Get in touch. You can also get in contact with me even quicker on the Twitter, which is @McCartneyPod. That's basically the place where I post polls, pictures of Paul, upcoming news about the show, questions to you, the fans. You know, just trying to build a little small community, like I say. One thing that is interesting, though, is that the blog is now up to scratch. I know for several episodes I've been kind of bemoaning the fact that the blog's been kind of the weak link, the Ringo Starr of this podcast. But now, well, as I'm recording this, there is one article, but by the time this gets released, there might be two. But the first article is up and running. It's actually been quite a success. It's brought a lot of traffic to the blog, to the podcast, which is always good. But it's great for me, personally, just to be able to vent my rambling Paul musings into a different medium. It was fun writing the articles. I hope you enjoy reading them. The first one up at the moment is my attempt to rebuild Red Rose Speedway. Obviously, Red Rose Speedway, our fourth episode of the official run of podcasts. That was Wing's second album, Paul's fourth since he broke up with the Beatles. And it wasn't what we wanted. It wasn't what we asked for. And as we discussed, there were loads of songs that were cut from the original double album. So in this article, I essentially tried to go back and try and reconstruct what that album might have looked like, or at least the album that I would have liked. And then the other article after that will be an analysis of all of the songs that Paul McCartney wrote to and about John Lennon. So, you know, I'll just be making a small compilation of what all of these songs meant, what Paul was trying to say to him at that time, and how what he was trying to say changed over time as history progresses. And I'll be adding a new article to the blog every week. I'm going to be a lot more strict with this now, folks, and there'll be much more content for you in the future. You can find the blog at paulmccartneypod.wordpress.com. That's paulmccartneypod.wordpress.com. Obviously, you can find us on YouTube just by typing in Paul McCartney Podcast or Paul or Nothing. You can find us on Facebook again just by typing in Paul or Nothing. But the big one, folks, we are yet to have an iTunes review out there. I'd really appreciate you taking the time to going on iTunes, giving us those 5 stars. Obviously, I'm not totally sure about how all the algorithms work and that kind of thing, but it does help give the show a bit of exposure, a little bit more anyway. Hopefully, a few more people out there who might not know we exist, they might be into other podcasts. After a few reviews, it might come up in their feed and bam, the community's grown. And whilst you might not see the results, it does help out the show in a big way and I'd really appreciate it. Now, lastly, of course, we have our Patreon page. Obviously, by now, the Patreon mini episode will have been uploaded. Hopefully, all of you will have already downloaded that, checked that out, listened to that, absorbed what I had to say. Perhaps you might have agreed with me at the end of all of that the podcast might just be worth $1 a month. And obviously, you can check out the Patreon page itself to see what all the little tiers get you. Everything from a shout-out on the show to coming on to an actual album review episode with me personally. Obviously, you can check out all of them. Please donate what you think the show is worth. If you'd like to see the show expand and grow in the way it has, then please support us. Now that the men in the suits have left, though, as Linda might say, let's crack on with the business at hand. Like I say, no waffle, no rambling. We're going to keep this one tight, people. So, what are we actually discussing today? Well, you've probably already read the title by now, so you've probably worked it out. But yes, on the first of these Wings gig review kind of mini bonus episodes, we will be reviewing Wings' final performance ever. That's it. They would do nothing after this. There would be no reunions, no Reformation tours. This was it. We will be discussing the concert for Kampuchea, or the concert for Cambodia. So we find ourselves just after Christmas in 1979. Wonderful Christmas Time has been a sizable hit for Paul. You know, it's done the rounds and he's pretty much got some time to kill now between and he's got some time to kill before he would completely chuck the baby out with the bathwater and bin Wings in less than a year's time. Back to the Egg has also been a moderate success along with its non-album single Good Night Tonight. So you'd actually think things were going quite well for Wings, and you know, they've just come off a big UK tour and stuff, so things were on the up and up, surprisingly, for a band that was going to be gone in less than a year. However, elsewhere in the world, things were not going so well for all folk across the pond. Now, whilst I did do like a whole year of degree level history here in the UK before dropping out to do film studies, I thought it would be best if I were to let my good old friend Wikipedia explain what the Cambodian genocide was all about. The Cambodian genocide was carried out by the Khmer Rouge, or Khmer Rouge, the KR regime, led by Pol Pot between 1975 and 1979, in which an estimated 1.5 to 3 million people died. The Cambodian Civil War resulted in the establishment of the Democratic Kampuchea by the victorious Khmer Rouge Rouge, which planned to create a form of agrarian socialism founded on the ideals of Stalinism and Maoism. The subsequent policies caused forced relocation of the population from urban centres, torture, mass executions, use of forced labour, malnutrition and disease, which led to the deaths of an estimated 25% of the total population of Cambodia. The genocide ended in 1979 following the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia. As of 2009, 23,745 mass graves have been uncovered. So this was, of course, a massive news story. This was seen all over the world. It was one of those tragic things that the media would blare constantly. It's obviously very similar to the situation we have with North Korea today. But rather than, say, sending in Trump to go fire missiles at them, instead the idea was to just try and help the people rather than topple the regime, you know, try and help the society from the bottom. One of the weirdest facts about this genocide was its choice of victim, weirdly. The dictator, the leader Pol Pot, who, for those of you in the UK who watch a lot of NAF TV, might also confuse with the opera singer Paul Potts. He wanted to get rid of any intellectuals, you know, the people he saw as the enemy, and he saw fit that, and you know, he saw fit to point out to his subordinates that the people who were intellectuals were simply people who wore glasses. I'm not sure how that's an indication of intelligence, but anyway, if you were to take anything away from all of this, it would be that there was some seriously reprehensible shit going on in Cambodia at the time. So the story goes that the event was organised by Paul himself, and Kurt Waldheim, who was then the Secretary General of the UN, in response to this catastrophic human rights disaster. This isn't raising money to allow kids to have free tennis lessons in inner city schools. No, no. This is send us money to stop people dying. This is serious shit. And, you know, Paul, of course, has always ever been the humanitarian, ever the campaigner. So this would be right up his alley. Though it seems kind of, if he had done it on his own, he probably wouldn't have been able to organise it in the way that Paul does. It could have ended up as a failed magical mystery tour of concerts. So having Waldheim as the man in the suit to get things organised meant Paul could focus on the music and getting the acts together and making sure it was a good time for everyone. Oh, I'm sorry, folks, I have to take it. Although, as things turns out, much in the way they do, it seems the whole, you know, Paul and Waldheim coming together to put on this show is actually a little bit of a misnomer. It seems the whole thing was actually arranged by Waldheim as this quasi-fanboy dream excuse just to get the Beatles back together. Yeah, seriously. I mean, Christ. I'm starting to feel like Paul at this point. Like, forget Wings, though. Is this podcast ever going to escape the shadow of the Beatles? I hope so. So, yeah, Waldheim, you know, sweet talks Paul, saying he's going to do this charity event together. And essentially, it's just a vehicle to allow him and everyone else, I presume, in 1979, to live the ultimate fantasy that is the Beatles getting back together. You know, just in the same way that any modern superhero or action tentpole film will put out a little bit of a teaser trailer to build hype. The initial gossip that sparked public interest in this whole concert for Camp Cheer thing in the first place was the idea that John, Paul, George and Ringo would put aside all their differences and do another gig. And I can understand that people would be excited and hopeful, as the social pressure for a reunion would be doubled, if not quadrupled, for the fact that it was done for charity. And the first reports of this setlist did include Ringo Starr and George Harrison, albeit as solo acts doing their own stuff. But either way, this would have been fantastic. You know, at least all the Beatles could have been under one roof together, signalling how they've got over a lot of their quarrels and they will gladly perform their solo stuff for each other. It could have been really nice. However, as soon as the papers caught wind of this, Harrison and Starr kind of panicked and pulled out immediately. It just seemed like it was too much hassle. And I can kind of understand where they're coming from. But out of kind of desperation, it gets to the point where this Waldheim fellow was literally calling out, begging Lennon to come and be the kind of linchpin for the reunion to kind of get everyone back together, but to no avail. And eventually Paul, after many, many irritating phone calls, would have to sit down and tell Waldheim that, you know, all while, you know, the machinations of this concert are already being put together and being put in place, that he couldn't get him the Beatles. But he certainly could get him Wings and a whole bunch of other guys. Now, what we can't forget, unfortunately for Paul at least, is that this was not the first time something like this had been done. In fact, only 8 years before, one of his old bandmates, George Harrison, had done something extremely similar. Yes, you know, who could forget the magic that is George Harrison's concert for Bangladesh? You know, it's such a phenomenally good show. And if George, that little guy who wouldn't play the solos the way Paul wanted, could get Bob Dylan, Ravi Shankar and Eric Clapton, well then Paul was definitely going to get an even bigger and better lineup of superstars that will help him with his cause. Now, being Paul here, I can imagine him being the veritable kid in a sweet shop or candy shop to you Yanks. He essentially gets the pick of the litter and chooses whoever he damn well pleases. You know, people will line up to work with Paul, people will be biting at the bit to do something like this. You know, the press and the publicity that would go along with something like this would also be too much to pass up. And, you know, to Paul's credit, the lineup could have been a whole lot naffer based on our history with him and what kind of music he's into. Because, in all fairness, we have Queen, we have The Who, and Elvis Costello making up the lion's share, the meatier part of the lineup. And, you know, if Paul can't make Wings, this seminal rock band that he always kind of wants them to be, then he can simply invite other bands who do it better to do it for him. Everyone's a winner. You can also see Paul was leaning towards accepting this more modern, new wavy type of music and the bands that went along with that. You know, he's inviting The Specials, The Clash, The Pretenders, and a lot of this makes sense. But, you know, both just because Paul's a nice guy and he wants to champion new talent, but Paul himself has also been experimenting with similar sounds on Wings' last album, Back to the Egg, which had a very new wavy feel, as well as some kind of rockier, punkier elements, as well as going, you know, balls deep in these youthful soundscapes on McCartney 2, which was just around the corner. Then again, was Paul just trying to appeal to, you know, or worse, try to look cool in front of a younger audience that he feared would simply not turn up if it was just the old vanguard of Wings and The Who and Queen? Who knows, but it creates a very wonderfully diverse and eclectic lineup that kind of was missing from the concert for Bangladesh. It was very much the George Harrison Travelling Wilburys type experience, really. You know, it was very much George's type of music. Whereas Paul's one here does, at least on the surface, seem to be more for the people. One of the guys who sadly couldn't make it was the Who's drummer Keith Moon. Moon had unfortunately lost his life to the, quote, mountain of pills he swallowed on the very same night that Paul had actually asked him to come and be the drummer for the orchestra. And no, I'm not actually going to do a joke about how I don't know which fate is worse. Not because it's in bad taste, it's just not very funny. John Bonham eventually filled in for Keith Moon's place, joining Steve Holly on the drums. And again, it's just one of those what ifs. What if Keith Moon had been at the orchestra? I doubt it would have saved it, but I digress. Another person who was meant to be part of this original lineup was Lennon. No, not John Lennon, but a 16-year-old fledgling musician, Julian Lennon. He ended up ducking out of the final gig purely because of the rumours of a Beatles get-together, and he was worried that that would overshadow him and he'd look like he was trying to ape off the success of the band before him, so he just pulled the plug. Unfortunately, for some reason, they couldn't get him back on stage after they realised that the Beatles weren't getting back together. You know, this would have been a great introduction to Julian Lennon, and who knows, his career could have been massively different than it was today because of this. Again, who knows, what if? So, I guess if Paul couldn't do a concert like this first, you know, he was certainly going to do it bigger and louder and more brash. And there really isn't much of a Cambodian pop scene in the UK at the time or now. So there's not going to be any of that inviting people from the affected areas to come and perform stuff going on. So, you know, there's going to be plenty of room for all the acts. It's all going to be all rock all the time. Instead of one gig, though, it would actually be stretched over 4 nights with many acts per night, all live at the Hammersmith Apollo Theatre. For those of you who don't know, that's one of England's most prestigious venues. It's absolutely massive. It's a wonderful place. And on the 26th of September, the first night, we had Queen. And this is the only night where it's just one act. I guess even Paul knew that no one could follow Freddie Mercury, even back in 79. On the 27th of September, we had Ian Dury and the Blockheads with guest Mick Jones on the song Sweet Jean Vincent. We had Matumbi, who I've never heard of. I'm going to check them out after the podcast. And finishing off, we had The Clash. Fantastic. The next day, on the 28th of September, we had The Pretenders, we had The Specials, Big Up Coventry, and The Who. And thank God those two bands went on before The Who, because, my God, who would even care? And I believe, along with Queen, The Who and Queen did the two longest set lists. You know, they were proper established gigs that may not have even necessarily looked like they were part of the Concert for Cambodia in the first place. You know, these were massive sets. And then the final night, the 29th of September, we opened up with Elvis Costello and The Attractions. Then we had Rockpile with Robert Plant guesting on the song Little Sister, followed, of course, by Wings, and then, naturally, the Rockestra Band. To further cement itself as the son of the Concert for Bangladesh, this concert too would be recorded and distributed as a concert film to go alongside the album. Like said album, it too would essentially wind up being as much as a mishmash of the greatest and not so greatest moments from all four gigs. So, like the album, there are just unfortunately too many cooks around this pot and the broth is horrendously spoiled from the get-go. And the result in, you know, both the album and the movie was that barely any of these artists, you know, all these noteworthy performers having any kind of presence at all, really. To put it in context, they filmed whole movies about these guys and everyone gets boiled down to a quick cameo. You know, there's one song by The Specials, there's one by The Pretenders. Like, this could have been a big triple album, big quadruple album, but no, it gets boiled down to the bare essentials and some of the most tepid song choices that perhaps Paul had his hand in there. But what you might consider to be a lot of the defining moments from these bands is not included. A funny little piece of trivia about from these four performances comes several months later when Paul was actually listening to the radio and heard a little bit of a snippet of this gig and seemingly forgetting he'd actually made the album in the first place. He rang said radio station up, you know, angrily demanding they tell him why they were playing a Wings bootleg, despite the fact that the record was in every shop on the high street. Egg on his face, to say the least. So let's move on to the set list now. And, you know, very much like the rest of the bands that would go on to appear on the album, Wings is no different. The section on the vinyl was only a couple of Wings songs out of the whole night. There was a much bigger set list provided for everyone there. But what's actually represented on the album were Got to Get You Into My Life, a Beatles song back from the Revolver days, a suitably heavier rendition of Every Night from McCartney's first solo record, and the Wings version of McCartney's upcoming hit, Coming Up, as well as a little snippet of Let It Be and the Rockestra right at the end. The other songs that were included on that nice set list, though, were Getting Closer, Again and Again and Again, I've Had Enough from London Town, No Words, which is one of Danny Lane's best songs ever. He had Cook of the House. Lawrence Juber, when he came on the show a few months ago, was extremely gracious and very democratic when I asked him about whether he and the rest of the band were excited to play this song or not. I will leave that up to him to declare in the future, but I'd take a stab at saying perhaps he didn't think that this was the best song to put out there, especially for this concert. We had Old Siam, Sir, Maybe I'm Amazed. Paul did a version of The Fool on the Hill from the Magical Mystery Tour, which I'd love to hear. I'd love to hear if anyone out there has a copy of this audio. I'd be very interested to hear that performance. We had Hotter Sun, an instrumental from McCartney One. Again, I've never heard this one live. If anyone knows if there's any secret bootleg of this gig that I can't find, you know, containing these songs, then please let me know. Send an email into paulmccartneypod@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter @McCartneyPod. Other songs included the punky Spin It On from Back to the Egg. We had Eddie Cochran's 1957 single, 20 Flight Rock, Go Now, the Moody Blues song, presumably performed by Denny Lane. Then we had Arrow Through Me, Goodnight Tonight, the Beatles song Yesterday, which Paul had also performed on the Wings Across the World tour, rounding things off with Mullock and Tyre, and of course Band on the Run. Now, what's interesting about the final track listing on the actual album itself, that was to be released after the concerts themselves, is that they seem to heavily favour Paul as a solo artist or as a Beatle, but not as a member of Wings. And it's not like they didn't have many songs to choose from either. You know, there are so many classic Wings songs in this setlist, but none of them get a look in. I mean, I know there's only limited room on the album, you know, with so many other big names, but it just feels a little bit fishy to me. Like, the fact that Paul would choose a song from the pre-Wings McCartney 1, when his next album, McCartney 2, was looking ever more imminent and around the corner, just brings up the question of how much heart he had in Wings as a band by this point. Was he just plugging his own stuff because he knew the end was nigh? Had he already, you know, internally made the choice to leave the band at this point? Or were these simply the best songs that he thought were performed on the night? Something tells me not really. And it's clear that we're not only seeing this now retroactively either. Wings guitarist Lawrence Juber, who I mentioned just again, who we had on the show a few episodes ago, was speaking about this rather like kind of lackluster wind down that was this final Wings performance. He said the following: "There was a growing sense from Paul that it was getting to the end game of the band. And by the time they'd left the stage, you know, presumably to do mountains of cocaine with all the other rock stars, that was it. Wings were to be no more. This was the very last time anyone would ever see Wings perform again. That is it. Nothing more. The story ends here." Yes, they had the tour in Japan coming up, but we all know how that ends. So, does Paul's seeming lack of commitment to the band come out at all in the music? Not really. Like, he's still a professional and he gives it his all in his classic McCartney way. You know, ever the showman. He does belt out the tunes. Everyone's in key, surprisingly. The rest of the band, how were they? You know, they held their own. It was pretty much the same performances that they'd been giving, you know, throughout their entire UK tour of that year. They seem to be kind of cruising a little bit. The band aren't as close and tight as they were, say, during the Wings Over the World days. But they do have an energy and a refreshing take on the Wings format that does make it very interesting to listen to. And it's always fascinating to see how these newer versions of Wings take that old material and repackage it and repurpose it for their new audience. However, Lawrence Juber is ever the solid presence on guitar. I love Steve Holly's drumming in all of this. He definitely evokes the best parts of Denny Sewell and Joe English. Like I say, everyone's surprisingly in key. Though, this might all just be a fluke, whether there was something done in the editing room or not, I don't know. But in Howard Soon's book, Fab, Howard Soon's another guy we had on one of our earlier bonus episodes, he described the day's events as the band pretty much getting trapped inside the Hammersmith Apollo, probably due to this kind of Beatles furore that was happening outside. And to pass the time, the band essentially just started getting absolutely hammered. And according to some who were there, that did come out in the performance. The drummer, Steve Holly, when asked about the performance, said, "It was a pretty messed up deal, really. I don't think that performance was particularly good at all." And I think that's a little bit harsh. Like, it is kind of generic Wings at this period. And Wings, even at its best, has always been a little bit creaky and rusty and croaky. But it's nowhere near as bad as something for, like, you know, their 1972 university tours or their first UK tour. This is still a far more polished Wings than we actually deserve for a version of Wings that's only got one album out by this point. But perhaps maybe Steve was glad that the majority of this gig has been lost to the annals of time / distribution hell. We also have the performance of Let It Be, and that's actually more by Wings plus many other special guests. from the Rockestra band. So it's hard to call it wings, really. Then again, if you go by the definition of wings, as a bunch of musicians doing what Paul tells them to, then the whole concert was performed by wings, really. Unfortunately for me, as a critic, as a broadcaster, and for you, the listener, my opinions on this gig, you know, the very first in this series, is rather restricted. As despite the size of this global charity event, there's only limited surviving audio from this gig at all, making it a somewhat semi-lost performance from the band. Yes, a great pick for the first review mini-episode. Yeah, you know, I could have chosen a better bootleg, but hey, I wanted to give this gig its own episode for a while, and I didn't want to bloat either the Back to the Egg or McCartney 2 episodes, so, you know, whatever. But yeah, it's very frustrating when you find out that the only things we have out there are a bit of audio and video from the Got to Get You Into My Life segment and the audio from Every Night Coming Up, Let It Be, and the Rockestra. It's very limited. It's a very small section of the gig. Now, again, maybe these were the songs that Paul chose because they were the least obviously pissed in these. Maybe the rest of the show was an absolute complete shambles. Who knows? Perhaps there is a reason why this hasn't been re-released. Perhaps there is a reason why most of this is lost. However, in a turn of fortune, it's pretty interesting for me because coming up and every night from the perspective of discussing how a song is performed went from the perspective of discussing a live gig, these are the two most interesting songs on the set list anyway. So phew. So quickly talking about Every Night.
Every night I just wanna go out, get out of every day, I don't want to get up, get out of my bed.
This version of Every Night from McCartney 1 almost absolutely completely rebuilds the entire thing from scratch. Yes, you know, the words and the time signatures are all the same, but the feel, the atmosphere and the tone are all completely alien. And by God, is this one of the live versions that Paul has given us that really exceeds expectations and creates something new and interesting. Rather than just adding a bit of speed for energy or doing an unnecessarily stripped down cover version, what McCartney does with Every Night here is essentially updating that small, homely McCartney 1 track and updating it for a bigger band performance. You've got that really heavy, slow, droning bass. Like, boom, boom, boom. Like, it's so overwhelming. It's off the fucking chain, and it's such a trendy update for such a personable song. You know, this is the "we have good night tonight" levels of funk going on here, folks, and the band really sells it. And overall, like, it's really hard for me to choose here, as I'm genuinely unsure as to whether I actually prefer this version more than the album version. The acoustic guitar is great in this one. The way McCartney sings it is really interesting and really soulful, and the rest of the band just back him up perfectly. It's a great version of this song, and it's just a shame to see that it's not the official version. You know, he's performed this song several times since, and he's never really done it in this dark, murky, threatening version that Wings performed ever again, really. However, where things come to a bit of a grinding halt for me is when we start to discuss Coming Up. In a few weeks, obviously, I'll be covering this song in a bit more detail when we talk about McCartney 2, but I wanted to take the time to bring it up here, as I know that future conversation will be much more kind-hearted and fun for one simple reason. The album version of Coming Up has, and always will be, the infinitely superior version of the song. End of story. Good night tonight. Rather like Maybe I'm Amazed, Paul has chosen this particular way to perform the song, and by Jove has he stuck to it ever since. I feel that, you know, like if you check that performance he did on Jimmy Fallon's show, whether he's doing it on the Get Back tour in 89 to 90, whether he's doing it on his album Tripping the Light Fantastic, or even that god-awful version where he does it live on the roof on the Late Show on Letterman, McCartney takes what is one of my favourite tracks of all time and turns it into something so horribly generic and middle of the road. Like, maybe he feels like it's just one of those songs that's too complex to be faithfully translated from a live format. But he takes out any of that zany poppiness that makes me like the original so much to begin with. It loses that silly, loony element that's also present on the entire record. And by taking that out and turning it into something that will fit into his rock gig oeuvre, it loses all point for me. It's not meant to be this rousing fist pumper of a song that he's kind of Frankenstein stitched together to be. It just doesn't work. And another thing, to this day, the guitar, you know, has yet to ever be successfully recreated on the stage. It seems to be a rush job, but a rush job that he's kind of gritted his teeth and stuck to forever. I don't know why. It's a really bad version of the song. And yes, I know the version from Glasgow, the B-side, was the bigger hit in America. It's the version that the Yanks like, but I'm sorry, it's just not as good. Sonically, the overall quality of the gig was fair enough. I'm surprised what has survived so well, and it's very much just like that previous tour of the UK. It's up to that standard that the band was working at that time. It's perfectly serviceable, but like that tour, the rockier tracks do have a certain oomph and tactility to them, but the more poppy selections with the brass always sounded a little bit too overreaching, a little bit too overambitious, and they fall short, making the stage feel quite empty and small, and the grandiosity of a song like Jet or Band on the Run just isn't sold. You know, even the inclusion of Wings Over the World veterans Howie Casey and Thaddeus Richard couldn't save this flop. The orchestra at the end is exactly what you'd expect it to be. Again, no real spoilers here for my views on this song. Obviously, if you heard my conversation with Lawrence Duper, I kind of let him know I wasn't the biggest fan of the orchestra. I'm still not. And again, it's just the orchestra live. It's big, loud, over the top, well-intentioned, you know, both artistically and charitably. But overall, a complete mess. The song itself is so simple and dull that it's really hard to distinguish who's playing what and when. None of these classic rock musicians get any wiggle room from Paul, so no surprise there. We have no solos, no countermelodies, no jamming, nothing different. It's just the generic rock orchestra. The only highlight really is that Paul went through the effort of shipping in an entire wardrobe of silvery sequin jumpsuits and top hats for the entire orchestra to wear. And everyone agreed to actually wear them, you know, everyone from John Bonham to Robert Plant, except the Who's auteur guitarist Pete Townshend, who declared, "I'm not wearing any of that fucking shit." Paul later got him back by jokingly calling him out on stage as the only lousy sod who wouldn't wear a silver suit. So, overall, is this a good gig? Yeah, kind of. Like much of the UK tour in 79, this gig is a painfully teasing look for me at where Wings could have started to go. Steve Holly and Lawrence Duber had enough time in the band now that they were slowly starting to ease into the rhythms of the band and becoming a live act again. In this performance, they're still a band playing music. This isn't Wings Over America. This doesn't have the same vaudeville showtime quality to it. There's not a lot of crowd interaction. There's nothing to make it stand out, really. There's nothing grabbing my attention with this. And the fact that this is the final Wings gig, unfortunately, means that Wings ended with a whimper rather than a bang. You know, wouldn't it have been great if they ended on Jet and Band on the Run and it was represented properly on the final album as the final Wings performance? But no, it's just clear that Paul had kind of lost his interest with the band. He wasn't really giving it. And, you know, despite giving it his all on stage, there's nothing that parallels that outside of that. He clearly has lost his faith in Wings, you know, he has become crestfallen, and he's just waiting to get out of the band at this point, which gives the whole performance a very somber and sad tone, really. Like, you know that this is the end, so perhaps it's very, very fitting that, you know, he finally broke out Let It Be for the first time in this gig. Let It Be was obviously going to be one of the songs that he will go on to perform forever. It's very fitting that at the end of Wings, Paul is starting to see just how lucrative playing those Beatles songs for the fans actually is. Figuring out why this album, though, is out of print is beyond my meagre mortal faculties. I can only imagine that, you know, in the true avaricious manner of record labels, it has something to do with the fact that the myriad of artists involved weren't all signed onto Capitol Records at the same time. However, I'm not saying that I would have any intention of re-releasing it in the way that it was originally distributed. You know, again, see my Red Rose Speedway article and you will see how I like to reorganise old albums, i.e. actually including the good stuff. Because, you know, for whatever reason, it seems the bands are hardly putting their best song forward, really. We are missing Ian Dury's Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. The Who could have put on Pinball Wizard and My Generation. The Clash did London Calling. And Queen had such insanely catchy tunes as Killer Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody, and A Crazy Little Thing Called Love. And yet, for some reason, none of that is included. Again, people, is this too hard? It's a money thing. People will buy this stuff. Re-release the concert for Campuchia, re-release it with the film, and re-release it with all the songs from all four gigs. People will eat that shit up. You'll get Paul's fans, Queen's fans, The Who's fans, and The Clash fans, The Costello fans, The Ian Dury fans. This would appeal to so many people. Have it remastered, have it restored. It could be a perfect Christmas present. So overall, probably a more interesting gig than a good one. Wings were very much Wings at this point. They seem to be on autopilot, as it were, and that kind of mechanical chug saps any of the life that may have been on something like Wings Over America. Perhaps the band just had run its course by this point. And it is always sad because the band did seem like it was just on the brink of a big upswing, you know, something akin to Band on the Run. But as we know, as the story goes, it was not to last. This was the last Wings performance. And yeah, that's the end of it, folks. I told you it was going to be a short one. But before you go, please, please, please leave a comment, drop me an email, hit me up on Twitter. Let me know what you thought of this mini episode. Whether you want me to keep experimenting with this kind of content on the podcast or trying something completely different, please let me know. This was really fun to record. I hope you guys had just as much fun listening to it. Stay tuned next time for our Wings Over America episode, where I'll be joined by a good friend of the show and podcasting monster, Mr. Tom Quay. Till then, take care. Sit tight and keep listening to Pool People. Take care.